Good evening, everyone. I don't usually like drawing attention to whenever I don't have time, to put together a PowerPoint, but tonight I am going to bring that to the forefront that I forgot to, and I wish I hadn't, because of one reason, if nothing else, alone, which is I kind of wanted there to be two philosophies to be put on the board. And so you'll just have to envision it. You'll just have to use your imagination. I'm going to read it off. The first one is this, is the reminder, the truth, that God is a merciful, forgiving, and compassionate God. Okay? See that? Can picture it, understand it, and we can grasp it, right? God is a merciful, forgiving, and compassionate God. Then the other side of the coin, and they don't have to be opposite sides, but still, God wishes for us to live a fulfilling life, which involves making the best and wisest choices according to his will. And I used that as two opposites because I find the challenge of that, if nothing else, talking to kids and teaching kids and thinking about my time with kids, as like, what's the emphasis there? Like, what should we prioritize the most? Initially, you got this one. You're like, you do want to praise the idea of God as a good, compassionate, forgiving, and there for anyone kind of God. But you also do really want to emphasize that, yes, that's true, but like God really wants us to make the best choices, to have a blessed life, and to not run into pitfalls that could otherwise be avoided. You do want to emphasize and prioritize that, hey, like you should make wise choices, you should make a good life for yourself full of integrity and character and wise decisions, but you never want to be boastful. You never want to be arrogant. You never want to think of yourself too highly and forget the grace of God. And I don't think that that's a super challenging conflict there, but I think it's a balance, and I think it's going to be well illustrated in our subject tonight, which is talking about two brothers. We're going to be talking about two brothers who represent both sides, the complicated nature of that. One we drift to a lot when talking to children, and I think that that's good. I think that that's a good impulse, and that's Joseph. We know of Joseph as an individual who had good integrity, even whenever life was not kind to him, an individual who was above reproach, an individual who composed himself with respect, honor, and dignity, even whenever it was easily accessible to go the opposite way. And then you got his brother, his older brother, Judah, an individual who kind of represents everything that isn't. An individual who I think, based off the way Moses wrote it, was probably kind of a contrast between he and Joseph. An individual who, whenever Joseph may have swerved right, Judas swerved left, and he was a failure in many regards. And so I encourage you to turn over to Genesis 37. I've looked at this lesson. I don't think it's got the greatest structure. We're mainly telling a story, so you'll just kind of have to weave in with me and out. We'll read a couple passages, but I want us to think about these two stories. You are probably familiar with both individuals. There are 12 brothers to Jacob, known as Israel, who was one of the great patriarchs, but an individual who had a major pitfall, just like his father, is that he showed extreme favoritism to his favorite son, who was from his favorite wife. And all the boys, including the favorite, had to receive some pretty bad patterns from that. Like, we're not the recipient of good things because of their father's failure. Their father may have been a good man of faith, but man, they really, even in his older age, Jacob couldn't get a hold of what he received, which is favoritism that he didn't receive from his father. And it's a sad story that takes place here. And what transpires is that Joseph, being the second youngest brother, is given a lot of favoritism. And there's a lot of inner conflict between these boys, most of which come from the lesser favorite wife. And so much so that they want to kill him. They want to kill him. You're probably familiar with this story. But whereas Joseph is going to be a good example of an individual who's shrewd, who's wise, who's intelligent, who's organized, who's just a responsible individual, Judah also has his own shrewdness, his own good instinct that gets him far in life. And I don't know, maybe I'm putting too much into the page here, but notice with me in chapter 37, they get their brother, they throw him into a pit, waiting for him to die, essentially. Reuben, the eldest, is very self-interested. He says, I'm going to go and get him in the middle of the night, save his life, so that I will be daddy's favorite boy again, because he's fallen out. He took on his dad's concubine as his own for a moment, and he and his dad have never had a good relationship since then. In fact, as you look at Reuben's, tendencies throughout the rest of the book, it kind of feels like that, like, sad dog that got yelled at, and now he's like running with his tail between his legs the entire time, trying to gain the approval of his master again. So Reuben is thinking about that, but this is what Jude is thinking about. In chapter 37, verse 25, it says, then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry down to Judah. To Egypt. Then Judah, 26, said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And the brothers listened to him. So again, he's like, guys, we wouldn't kill a brother, would we? This is one of our own. And he's like, also, what financial gain is there if we get that too? Like, he's a shrewd guy. He knows how to survive. And again, maybe I'm putting too much emphasis on this, but like, you see the what Joseph's going to do is he's going to be a very shrewd, responsible man, but he considers his masters whenever he's in Potiphar's house. He considers Potiphar, and he says, I want to be a respectful and responsible man for Potiphar. And he considers his peers. You think about him with his working in the jail later on. He considers those he works with. He considers his fellow man. He's a man who considers his superiors, his peers, and obviously he considers his God. Judah, a wise man, a smart guy, a guy with a lot of like real life experience, is like, how can we get ahead of this by just killing the guy when actually we could get financial reward? Again, he just considers his needs. He just considers his wants. He just considers what'll get him through this moment. We're going to briefly tell the Joseph story. Joseph goes into Egypt, right? He gets thrown into Potiphar's house, and he's given a great opportunity to give in to sexual desire when no one's around because his boss's wife is very much attracted to him. And there's really no reason he couldn't have acted on that impulse. The world wasn't kind to him. In many ways, you could say God wasn't there for him. He put him in a place without his family. Who would really know? But you see this Joseph as this great example of the ideal specimen of running away from your temptation, running away from instant gratification, and considering God and considering the other people involved in this and considering others. It's a great example. But then we see from the Judah story, you could go to chapter 38. The Judah story, in fact, we're going to briefly go over this. I will be honest, chapter 38 is one of the more graphic chapters in the Bible, probably compared with that, the end of Judges. Like, it's not a fun conversation to have, especially if you're teaching teens, so we try to keep it as minimal as possible. But to briefly summarize here, Judah, kind of showing his character, showing his immaturity. He goes out and gets a wife from a Canaanite nation. He has at least three sons with this woman. The oldest son, he gives her a bride. And this son, again, whether it's Judah's fault or not, it seems like his son is just a wicked man, a rebellious man. You gotta say, like, he's probably taking after daddy a little bit, right? Like, whether that was, like, even further than Judah ever went, whatever the reason was, he dies. This son dies. God strikes him down, is what it says. So he gives, you know, his new, it's kind of like his property, his new daughter-in-law, he gives her the next son. This son is very sexually inconsiderate and inappropriate, and God strikes him down too. And this young maiden who's now responsible to Judah doesn't have a child and has gone through two husbands. In this moment, she's just kind of there as like, and probably in the ancient days, is there just as an extra mouth to feed. Where else is she supposed to go? Well, here's the thing. Judah, life hasn't been kind to him. He's lost his two oldest sons, and then his wife dies out of the blue. It's a very tragic deal, and you understand that this man is grieving, is going through a tough time, but still, he's compared to Joseph. He's not making wise decisions. He's not considering the error of his way. He's not considering the consequences that will happen. So his daughter-in-law uses the moment to be shrewd. She dresses up as a prostitute, pretends to be, puts a veil over herself, and seduces him. It's not a great story, but it's interesting reading that side by side with Joseph's like integrity and Joseph's purity and Joseph's consideration for God and for others. For Judah, in the moment of, again, where he felt like the world wasn't kind to him, he acts impulsively. And you see his character in this moment because whenever it comes about that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, has a child, is pregnant, and she doesn't have a spouse, she must be an immoral woman, even though he has done just as treacherous things with someone else he doesn't know, he says that's not okay, and he's willing to put her to death. He's willing to burn her until she shows him, like, hey, you were the guy. And this is kind of the quick mention here. She kind of, I don't know what you call him. She kind of tricks him, gives him some areas of identification, says, like, hey, I'm going to take this from you, your staff and your wires and all this stuff. And this is what we see in verse 26. Then Judah identified them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not know her again. This is kind of a confusing thing. Why is she more righteous than him? You could say that she was maybe had more integrity. She considered that he wasn't being fair with her. That's fine and dandy. This is kind of an explanation I found while I was studying it. It says the term used for righteous in this text is similar to 1 Samuel 24, verse 18, when Saul says it about David. And in it, this author is basically saying this, that this is kind of more of a superior telling an inferior, I'm sorry. That someone, like, this is their version of, I apologize, you were more worthy than I, you are in a better place than I am, you are of more honor than I. It's not exactly about moral correctness, righteousness. It's just more of a, hey, I apologize and I acknowledge you are a better place. Regardless, I want to bring this to your attention. This feels like the big slap in the face that Judah is finally starting to realize. He's lost his wife. He's lost two of his children. And now he has impregnated his own daughter-in-law. And he realizes, even if it's indirectly, he's responsible for all of this. This is a tragic, disgusting, immoral story. This is everything you don't want to deal with. Again, I don't know about you, but whenever I've taught Genesis, I've skipped over 38 more often than I have not, because it is an uncomfortable subject to discuss and to deal with and to consider. But you see in this moment that Judah understands, I have failed others, I have failed my morality, I have failed my children, I have failed my daughter-in-law, I have failed the world around me, and I'm the one responsible for it. And I tried to literally burn the failure in my life, and I realized I was the one responsible for every element of it. It's an uncomfortable story, but I think it's essential to understanding an important truth, is that he realizes in this moment the degree of what he is responsible for. We go over to chapter 43. Chapter 43, quickly catch us up to speed. What transpires is Joseph has really climbed the ladder. God has smiled upon him. It hasn't been without its challenges. He was thrown in prison for a while, but now he's essentially second in command of Egypt. Like, he's the guy who's he's a responsible, organized, wise younger man at this point. And so he's responsible for preserving the nation of Egypt as well as all the surrounding nations, like whenever there's a food crisis. Like, he's a guy who's that responsible and wise, and it's very cool. But, you know, the brothers finally come to him in need. They don't realize it's him, and they say, we need food, we need sustenance, and he gives it to them, but then he takes one of their own brothers, Simeon, and he says, like, I think you might be bandits. I think you might be stealing against Pharaoh. He puts them to the test, and he says, I need you to go back to your father, and I need you to bring your youngest brother, This would be his only biological brother, probably about 11 years old whenever he last saw him, just a kid. He says, I need you to bring him back. Otherwise, you're never going to see your brother Simeon ever again. Here's the thing. They go back, tell their daddy, and Jacob essentially says, not worth it. I could risk my youngest favorite child for a child who I know I'll never see again. Like, it's guaranteed I will not see him again unless this small possible risk takes place. And the dad says, no, it's not worth it. And all the boys who are there have to live with that they are all disposable compared to the favorite child. How tragic is that? Like, it's really like a horrible circumstance that takes place here. Reuben does this thing, again, really seeking the approval of dad. Because he has never gotten the right place with him. And what he does in chapter 42, verse 37, he says, like, hey, give Benjamin to me. Like, we're going to go back. We're going to get Simeon. If it doesn't happen, if something goes wrong, you can kill my own children. It's like, I don't care. You just, like, whatever the risk is, like, you put it on them. I'll be your favorite again. I'll be your number one. Jacob says, no, thank you. Some time transpires, so much so that they're all hungry, they all need food again. And he says, my sons, go get me food. Go get us food. We need to survive. We need to not die. We need to live. And they're like, we were explicitly told, if we go back, like, it's just not going to go well. Whatever that means. They are all imprisoned at that point. They're all like, you know, another one is taken. We're not really told, but he understands, like, we can't go back. So Judah steps forward. And this is just a lovely text. Chapter 43, Judah steps forward and says, we need to take this seriously. Basically, dad is trying to wake up. We have had opportunity to bring Simeon home, and you've rejected every opportunity. So here's what he says, chapter 43, verse 8 and 9. He says, and Judah said to Israel, his father, send the boy, send Benjamin with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of his safety from my hand, and you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. And I love this for a few reasons. First off, you just see character growth, man. You see a guy who finally gets it. You see an individual who's like, hey, I ain't putting the blood on like my children, like Reuben was desperate for. He's saying, I ain't threatening. I'm simply saying this, I'll bear the brunt. Whatever it takes, I'm going to go into that situation. I promise that if one person is at risk here, it's going to be me. If one person seeks blame and should harbor all the guilt, it's going to be me from now to the very day I die. I think that that's really incredible. But he also says this, unlike Reuben, he says like that we may all live and not die, and you, I, and all of our little ones. And what's interesting here is like, now it involves his two twin boys who he has given in birth, his daughter-in-law's birth, Tamar. They never got married after that point. These are his children that he now is responsible for. And he says, I see life in the potential. I see life in the possibility of the future. Whereas Reuben was like, man, like, kill my kids, I don't care. He's like, man, these children who shouldn't have been here, and any last children I have, he says, I see a future, and I see a possibility, and I see life before me, and I will pay the price to make that happen. And he does this all for his father, who's willing to risk him. As selfless of a love as can possibly be. I really think it's such a rich story. We get into chapter 44, and it kind of goes the way you would expect. Benjamin comes, and Joseph is thrilled. He's excited. He's very happy to have Joseph's thrilled to have his little brother back. So he gives him a lot of honor. But this is interesting. He gives him he gives them all a lot of food, gives them all the royal treatment, but he gives Benjamin like 10 times the amount as everyone else. What I think he's doing is he's setting them up for another test. He's saying, "You all turn your back on me because I was the favorite child, and that may not have been fair to you, but I didn't deserve the death penalty you marked on me. So I'm going to put that mark, I'm going to put that black check on Benjamin. And I'm going to put you all to the test and see if you're going to do the exact same thing. So you're going to see a lot of favoritism showed to Benjamin. How are you going to respond? As he sends them all out, he sets Benjamin up for failure. He puts some silver in his backpack. He goes off, and they catch him. They say he's a thief, and he won't go anywhere. So this is the opportunity. Are they going to, in this moment, risk Benjamin for their own safety, for their own preservation, for making things right and fair again? Are they going to consider him? And this is, as you know, the story. Judah steps forward. Verse 18, chapter 44, verse 18. From 18 to the end of the chapter is really Judah's great, like, summary of what's happened to this point. But he says in verse 18, then Judah went up to Joseph, who he didn't realize, went up to him and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ear, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself." He goes on to relay the story, everything that took place up until this moment, being as detailed as he can be. Then verse 30, he says this, "Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy Benjamin is not with us, then as his life is bound up in his boy's life, as soon as he sees that Benjamin, his boy, is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father.'" I think that statement's kind of the great summary. In this moment, he's chosen a selfless love for his father. He loves his father just like Reuben does, but he says, "I will pay any price to not see the evil come upon him. I don't want to see the tragedy upon him. I don't want to see the torment and the days and the years, if not even the moments, maybe he'll die on the spot, that will come to him." And this is a father who wasn't willing to pay that price for him. But still he says, "I will not see that evil be upon him. Put that evil upon me. Put that unfairness, that failure upon me." I think it's a really beautiful story. I think it's a beautiful story because what you'll see takes place here. Let's read 55. "Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, 'Make everyone go out from me.' So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer to him, for they were dismayed at his presence." Very cool story. You can continue to read on about their reconciliation. It's a beautiful story. I love seeing it take place. But it's really cool, if nothing else, to see a story of someone who through such a selfless and kind of out of nowhere act of love and sacrificial love was able to build relationships that felt like irreconcilable, if that's the word. I don't know if it is. The book of Genesis deals with brothers at odds the entire time. It kind of opens up with one brother killing another. And it sort of exemplifies that, like, our relationship with God is often broken whenever I fail to see my brother and my sister around me as worthy of the same respect I would give God. And you see brothers at odds the entire book, right? You see Jacob and Esau, Isaac and Ishmael. You see all 13 or 12 of these guys. Like, it's just a story about brothers who can't get along, and it's this great story of humanity. And Judah's part of the story of a great failure of a man in desperate need of a second chance, in desperate need of help, willing to make a step that no one else was and fix a relationship that can never be fixed. Even whenever it gave him no opportunity, even whenever it gave him no, like, advantage, it's a story of no matter where you are, no matter how far in life you've gotten, no matter how desperate you feel like you are unworthy of it, like, God uses you. So I'm going to very briefly mention this. I think that the story of Joseph should be the emphasis because it is a great story of what integrity looks like, of what character looks like, and looks at how even when life isn't fair to you and you uphold your faith in God, that God blesses you, and how amazing and incredible is that. And it's something I hope that kids and young adults and every single person in this room takes with them. But I think the other side of the coin, the story about complete humility, complete rejection of God, and complete evil, when willing to humbly look themselves in the eyes and see the error of their consequences, is a great story. So here's what I have to say. This is why we need the Judah side of the story, very briefly. Number one, Judah shows that change is difficult and the long road ahead of you as you continue on in life. It's hard to It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. Is that the phrase? But well within reach for those who are dedicated. I also think the Judah side of the story is well worth telling because Judah shows that you can start to see the needs of others over your own and step into the need where you can, even when you have failed to do so again and again. It's sometimes embarrassing to fail someone, to embarrass yourself in front of someone, to realize that you have not been the person you should be, and it's often easy to push yourself away from those circumstances and say, well, I've already failed. This is a story about someone who did that continually and still says, I can still be the person that this other person needs. It's great. Number three, I think Judah shows us that you can use even your worst failures to cause you to grow into integrity and potential if you choose to use it and see it correctly. This is a story about a man who learned from his failure and used that failure to propel him to be a better man with the time and the days and the opportunities that were still ahead of him. I think it's incredible truth. The last one I think is awesome. I think most of us know this, but it's a nice little biblical, behind the curtain, like a great reveal. Judah shows us that not only is God not done with the worst of us, but he can use us beyond what we might hope and think for ourselves. And that's this story about a man who's lost a lot of his family, who now has children that should be a great embarrassment, and yet still works and tirelessly gives of himself for them and for their future. And because of that, the elder of the two, Perez, of the two twins, goes on to be in the line of Christ from both he and Tamar. You guys probably know that, but Matthew chapter 1 talks about how Perez is in the line of Jesus. And God uses this great story, and it's mentioned about in Ruth also, where sometimes these lineages of Christ don't always come from places you'd expect. God uses them, and God can use us no matter where we are for things beyond what we can imagine or think or hope for our lives, even if you don't really see them take place in your own days. I think it's an incredible truth that hopefully we all take to heart. What I want to do is I want to quickly close with chapter 41. This is kind of backtracking, and it's moving ourselves away from the literary use of brothers. We see that Judah and Tamar give birth to twins, and God uses those twins. And then we're going to look over to Joseph and his two sons, and this literary example of brothers being an important theme throughout. But in chapter 41, and again, this is sort of an offshoot, and this was something I was thinking about writing for another time, for a different lesson, but I thought it was good enough I was going to use it here. Chapter 41, verses 50 says this: before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bore them to him, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For, he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. So this is an interesting example of names being important. Manasseh is about forgetfulness. And we understand he doesn't forget his father's house. He doesn't forget his past. But it's this important truth that no matter the tragedy, no matter the circumstance, no matter the time that he was in Egypt, which is kind of like this example of whenever you are not where you should be, whether because you chose to do so like Judah or because life wasn't fair to you like Joseph, God can still be the one to make and minimize the pains and the sorrows you have to live with year after year. So whenever you fail, whenever you have tragedy, whenever you have difficulty, understand that just like the example or the promise of Manasseh, God is the one who can make you heal your pain and your wounds. But we go on to say this, verse 52, the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And I liked this one, and this one stood out to me the most. The book of Genesis opens up with a prompt, with a command for man and woman. Go out, be fruitful, and multiply, right? Like, that's the, you know, again, it's like literally go have children, but that's also like our spiritual push is to go out and to be those who bring the goodness of God, to multiply, to be fruitful where God has placed us. And this is an interesting truth, both about Judah and about Joseph, is that both those guys were not placed in very nice places. That Joseph was placed in Egypt, and it didn't seem fair, and it felt like a barren land, and it was literally a famine at certain parts. But you can still be fruitful where God has placed you. And retconning this name for old Judah, Judah made a life of really poor decisions, really terrible choices that brought about consequences, and he had to live in those consequences. But even in those consequences, even in his spiritual Babylon, his spiritual Egypt, when he was at a place he shouldn't have been because of his own error and his own failure, God still used him to multiply. God still multiplied within his life, obviously literal children, but also a path forward. There's a literal part of this story that, like, the lineage of Christ could have literally been burnt up because of the anger and the failure to reconcile one's own failure of one man because of his arrogance, his selfishness, his failure to look to the world around him and to ultimately look to his true father who mattered the most. But whenever he chose to do so, he stopped where he was, dealt with the failure of it. There was multiplication. There was fruitfulness. There was goodness on this land. And so we end with the words of Joseph to his brothers who were scared that after their father had finally died, that maybe he was just, it was all a front and they were actually angry. You know this passage, chapter 50, verse 20. Joseph says this to all of his brothers. As for you, including Judah, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Because Judah was willing to look ahead and to see life into places that he thought should have been dead and shouldn't have existed and he didn't have a chance at. And he was willing to, at an older age, at a place where he already made enough failures, see the prospect of life. God used it to make many live. And yes, that is a grand story about Joseph and his dedication and his integrity, and we should never minimize that. But it's also the story of someone who felt like a failure, who felt like he had no hope, and who felt like everything around him should burn. And he chose to trust in the God who gave him an opportunity. So many lived because of that. Let's remember that reminder today as together we stand and together as we sing.